around 10-something last night about the sermon, and he said, make sure you don't say any Packer jokes. I wrote him back and said, this is going to be my only joke. My dad texted me to say, don't make any Packer jokes. First Timothy chapter 3, verses 8 to 13. I wasn't actually aware. Thanks for sharing that, Cliff, about the political reasons for the word deacon. It makes sense why that word would have been selected, given that in Greek the word is diakonos. And so it certainly sounds similar to the Greek terminology. And it also distinguishes, there are a lot of people in the New Testament that are referred to as servants. Paul is called a servant. Timothy is called a servant. There are people that are serving in unofficial capacities, and I think perhaps to draw a distinction between the two, to recognize those in ordained ministries, a distinction between servant and perhaps deacon, so that we can know that these are people that have been set aside for an official position, in distinction from all of the other uses of servant in the New Testament. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 8 to 13. Sermon is entitled today, The Anatomy of Godly Leadership, Part 2. Talk about the deacon / question mark, the deaconess. There's a question about how verse 11 is to be translated, and I'll get there in just a moment. Right now, you're looking at a picture of a man most of you, probably all of you, don't know. I know him very well. His name is Red Laurel. He owns a gym in Lafayette, Louisiana, which is where I'm from. It is one of the top 10 gyms in the nation. He owns a gym that is so large, it's 20 acres of what Joey from the sitcom Blossom would say, whoa, 20 acres of wow. You're talking indoor-outdoor tennis courts, indoor-outdoor swimming pools, sauna, steam room, daycare, spa, snack bar, coffee bar upstairs, racquetball, squash courts, indoor track, basketball courts, different weight rooms, boot camps, a water park, all of this on this 20 acres of wow that Red Laurel's own. Started in 1963, and he added on over the years to the point where it's probably even bigger than it was last time I was in Lafayette. I was employed at Red Laurel's gym for 4 years during my undergraduate degree in college. Part of my tasks were to assist people that wanted to be put on an exercise regimen. Another one of my tasks was to keep the gym clean. A lot of people would, you know, they rack their weights, and then afterward their weights would be all over the place. And so periodically I would make sure that the gym was clean, if there are towels out of place and things of that sort. Another task that I did was to show people the gym. And it was very easy to do that, given it was 20 acres of wow. The gym really just kind of explained itself. But the way that they would get my attention, because this gym was so big, was that certain of the people that worked there, including myself, had walkie-talkies. And so if someone came up to the front desk and they wanted a tour or they wanted to sign up for a membership, they would radio us on the radio, and whoever of us that had a radio that was free would travel to the front desk, and we'd take care of whatever need was there. Now, there are a lot of memorable events at the gym, you can imagine. But one moment was more memorable than any others. And that was the time where I had walked up to the front and decided to use the restroom. And I saw Red Laurel, who was probably in his 70s at the time. He was on his hands and knees in a bathroom stall. Evidently, someone had had an upset stomach, and everything that was in their stomach came up out of their mouths. That was just a fancy way of me not having to use perhaps a word that some people may not like in the pulpit. So we'll just say that the contents of the stomach came out through the mouth and were all over the place on the door and on the bottom of the floor. And there was Red Laurel, the owner of the gym, who did not have to work there. He's a multi-millionaire. But he came to work, and that day, instead of verbally saying to some people at the front desk, you should go and clean up all of the mess. There's a mess in the bathroom. You need to clean it up. Or instead of saying, front desk, can you call one of the people with the walkie-talkies to come and clean it up? I don't think I would have ever have known that he did that unless I had just stumbled into the bathroom. But there he was, the owner of the gym, multimillionaire, on his hands and knees, without any fanfare, without calling attention to himself, without trumpeting it afterward, cleaning up a mess that someone else had made. And that stuck with me about what true service is. And it reminded me of a conversation that Jesus had with his apostles in Matthew chapter 20, which I'd like to read to you. Matthew chapter 20, verses 25 to 28. Starting in verse 25, Jesus called the apostles together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. It's not supposed to be that way with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great. Now, the apostles were just arguing about who is going to be the greatest. And Jesus takes the opportunity to tell them about what it really means to serve in his eyes. And he says, there are people in the world that lord it over and exercise authority. And that's not supposed to be that way with you. Here's how it should be, Jesus said, verse 26. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your what? Servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served. Here's God, the owner of the universe, the creator, the one through whom everything was created, and he came not to be served, but to serve. And this is how he demonstrated his service, to give his life as a ransom for many. And so thinking back to Mr. Red Laurels on the floor, the owner of the gym, and this scenario with Jesus and his apostles talking about service, there's some similarities and some differences. Mr. Red owned 20 acres of the gym. Jesus owns everything. The contents that were on the floor in the bathroom stall were caused by one person, and anybody could have cleaned it up. Even the person that who it came from could have cleaned it up. But it's not that way with sin, is it? The messes that every one of us has made and participated in. It started in one man and one woman, but all of us have contributed to and participated in creating and proliferating our own mess, and that mess the Bible calls sin, and the price of sin is eternal death and separation from God, and none of us can buy our way back with God. We can't clean up our own mess, and therefore the owner must come voluntarily. When we broke the law, he paid the penalty. If the metaphor is we're sick, he comes to provide the healing. The metaphor is that we are in darkness, light must come to those who are blind. And if the metaphor is that we are dead, zombies, until we are awakened, Christ comes to make us alive. And this is emblematic of the ministry that we will be talking about today, this way of serving to the point of laying down one's life, putting the needs of others before one's own, not seeking to be the greatest, but willing to be the slave of all, is depicted when the creator of the world comes and walks among us and takes on flesh for himself and takes upon himself our mess and our brokenness, and destroys it in the cross and his resurrection and offers us this new life, this new chance to serve him. And so that gets us to where we were last week and this week. There are two permanent forms of ministry in the New Testament. There is a presiding ministry, one in which the elders or overseers of the church exercise authority and teaching ministry. We talked about that last week, 1 Timothy 3:1-7. There's also what is called a ministry of service, a diaconate. And we'll talk about that today in 1 Timothy 3:8-13. But you know what the amazing thing about Jesus is that every single ministry that exists, if you think about it, there were apostles. Jesus is called an apostle. He was sent forth from God, Hebrews 3 says. There's teaching ministries. Well, Jesus was a teacher. There were prophets. Jesus is the prophet. Last week when we talked about elders, overseers, Jesus is called the chief shepherd. And this week when we talk about serving, Jesus in Matthew 20 is called the servant. And so all of these ministries are wrapped up together and modeled by this one man. And all of them are important. We shouldn't just say that because this deacons or servants or ministry servants, they're servants, they're not important. No, Jesus was a servant. And those whom God calls to serve in an official capacity are to represent Jesus and his ministry of service to us. It's a very valuable ministry. And so here's how I break down the passage as we talk about the ministry of service, the diaconate, those whom God calls to serve him in an official way. Now there's a problem in the text that I'll get to in verse 11. Verses 8 to 12 are all about qualifications. Qualifications for male deacons in verses 8 to 10, then it's interrupted by verse 11, and then the qualifications for male deacons pick back up in chapter 12. In verse 13, there are two results of serving well. Those two are pretty set in stone. There's not a lot of debate about them. There is some debate about verse 13 and what it means, and we'll get there. But then you get to verse 11, and who are these the qualifications for? Are they for women? If you look in your Bible, if you have the NIV, RSV, NRSV, there's the word women there. If you have one of the four versions listed under the second bullet point, there are wives there. Well, is this women in general? Is this the wives of deacons that Paul is talking about? Or there's one English translation, the Revised English Bible, that says this is women in the office of a deacon, a female deacon. Now, what is it? It could be any of the three. And I'll make a case for why I believe which one of these three it is in just a moment. But what I want to do is I want to kind of group together the verses a little bit unnaturally, but logically. So I want to talk about everything that 1 Timothy 3:8-13 says about deacons, male deacons. And so I want to talk about that together. So I'll treat verses 8 to 10 and verse 12. Those are the verses that talk about the qualifications for male deacons. Then I'll talk about verse 11 and make a case for what I think Paul is talking about there, what group he's talking about, whether it's wives of deacons, whether it's women in general, or whether it's an office of female deacons. So I want to talk about that separately, and then I'll talk about the results of serving well in verse 13. But it might be helpful to understand, if we're talking about male deacons, well, what did male deacons do? You know, if we're talking about a pilot or a stenographer or a truck driver, the qualifications often match what you're going to be doing on the job. So, for example, they wouldn't want me driving an 18-wheeler. Because I can barely back up a four-door car. I am the type of person, when we moved here from New York and had a car attached, I would have to, before I would back up, I would have to get out and go and see how much space I had behind the truck so that I didn't hit anything. And eventually I would get settled, but you wouldn't want me doing that. It's the same thing with pilots, for example. You wouldn't want to get in the plane with a pilot. You step on the plane with a pilot, and over the intercom says, you know, I haven't really had any flight training today, but I'm going to be flying the plane. How many of you would stay on the plane? None of you would, because there's an expectation that in a situation like that, you want someone that has logged on the minimum 1,500 or so hours. You'd be extra happy to hear, just to let you know, I've been flying for 30 years. I've been through 3 storms. Once I had to land the plane upside down. You wouldn't have wanted to be on the plane during that, but you would be very comfortable knowing that this is a man that had done all that, or a woman that had done all that and survived it. Because if anything happens in the air, this person has met the qualifications to land the plane safely. And so it might be helpful to understand, well, if we're talking about male deacons, what is it that they did? That might help us make sense of some of the qualifications that Paul mentions. So what did male deacons do? Deacons were often known as the eyes and ears of the overseers. They were his feet on the ground. They were his messengers. And they relayed information back to him. They would sometimes teach. They would catechize. Some of you come out of the Catholic tradition, you know, catechism. Well, what does that mean? Catechesis. You prepare people for baptism and then you help them grow in their faith afterward. Deacons in the early church would do that. If there were absent members that weren't able to attend the assembly on Sunday mornings, the deacons would take communion to them. They were messengers. They carried letters back and forth, correspondence between various churches. They served Christians in distress when Christians were persecuted and put in prison and needing assistance. The deacons often would be the ones to serve and help them. They cared for their needs. These were people that visited the sick. They had some pastoral roles in counseling, in empathizing, in traveling to visit those who were hurting and wounded and suffering. And they used church funds to help widows and orphans. Now, these are all of the things that church history attests that male deacons would do. And again, knowing what they did helps us understand the qualifications. And so because deacons represent in a special way the serving attitude and work of Christ, it makes sense that at the beginning, Paul would say they need to be people that are worthy of respect. People of integrity. I think all of the characteristics in verses 8 and 9 and 10 can be subsumed under the category of these are behaviors that show a man is a person of integrity. Oh, what's integrity? A person with integrity demonstrates sound moral and ethical principles and does the right thing no matter who's watching. To have integrity means that a person is self-aware, accountable, responsible, and truthful, and that their actions are internally consistent. What they profess and what they do, the reasons for why they do what they do, they match up. There's no hypocrisy there. And so this helps us understand how the deacon must live. He must be a person that lives with integrity. His life must be marked with integrity. And so since deacons were often messengers and they went back and forth between two parties and they visited people and they developed relationships, and when you develop relationships with people and you hear their problems, and when you become aware of their problems, what's their tendency to do? You can cause division by gossiping about those people. There's also the potential for, in any church, there is drama. In any church. And when you get to know people well, you become aware of the problems and the conflict and the drama that's involved in their lives. And if you're a deacon and you're visiting these people, going back and forth, and you're getting to know them and you're becoming aware of their problems, you can really be a person that gossips. And that perhaps is why Paul says that they are not to be double-tongued, literally. They're to be sincere. You're not to speak in two directions, not to say one thing here and one thing over there. The deacons were supposed to be people that were trustworthy in their speech. They were not people that used information to wound unnecessarily, but they could be trusted. They were sincere. They were not double-tongued. They were not to indulge in drinking much wine. And we talked about this. This is one of the similar characteristics of the elder. They're not to be given to much wine. It's the same with the deacon. And why is this the case? Because drinking to excess often leads to sinful behavior. Illicit relationships happen sometimes with drinking. Fighting, whether it be physical or verbal, is associated with drinking. And so the deacon is not to be indulged in much wine. Paul says that they are not to pursue shameful gain. They're not to be greedy for dishonest gain. Now, if you do a Google search, you go online, Jackson, and you look up church scandals, you can find hundreds, if not thousands, of ministers, pastors, ministry leaders that have taken advantage of people, that have scammed people, and that have misused funds. And that has often caused some people to abandon the faith because the leaders are not leading, or they're not serving like they should. And because the deacons were often entrusted with handling benevolent tasks for the widows and the orphans, this means that they would have had access to money. And because they have access to this money, it means that they would need to be people that know how to use it responsibly. People that are content with what God has given them and not pursuing dishonest gain. Now take a look at verse 9. Chapter 3 and verse 9. They must keep hold of the deep truths of the faith, literally the mystery of the faith, with a clear conscience. And that makes sense to me, because if a deacon's role, part of it was to teach or to catechize, to educate people for baptism and to help them grow in their faith afterward, then it makes sense that they would need to know the faith well and to hold on to it. And they couldn't just profess the faith. There are people, it is possible to know about God, but to not know God. To make a profession and not to live it out. The deacons were not to be such kind of people. They were to be people who knew the faith well. They could tell you why Jesus took on flesh. They could tell you the importance of his resurrection. They can tell you how he conquered sin. And they were to hold on to that. And that was to impact how they lived. They were not to be hypocritical people. They hold fast to the faith with a clear conscience, Paul says. Verse 10, any candidate that is put forth to be recognized in an official way as a deacon must be subjected to scrutiny. Take a look at verse 10. They must first be tested. That's step one. Step two, then if there is nothing against them, some versions might have blameless. They need to ace the test. Then step three, let them serve as deacons. And so in any candidates that are put forward, there must be an examination. And not just a surface level examination. This is scrutiny. This is putting someone's life under a microscope. How many of you have purchased homes? How many of you, you don't have to raise your hands, how many of you would be willing to purchase a home without an inspection? Some of you saying, no, it's not recommended that you do that. Some people do it to save money and they often wind up regretting it. Why? Because there are latent defects in homes that are often undiscoverable to the naked eye. And it takes a professional inspector to go up in the attic and to test for radon and to see the tuck pointing and the cracks in the building and to check the foundation and to see the wiring behind the walls, to check if there's termites that have kind of eaten away at certain parts. So the Wall Street Journal, in an article, in a study, said that 2 out of every 5 houses have at least one major defect. And so that's why there's a recommendation that you should never buy a house without inspecting it first. Because inspection uncovers these latent defects, these out-of-sight things. And you might discover that that beautiful ivy on the side of the house is crawling up on the roof, and it could damage the roof. If you find out that behind the walls there's stuff concealed in inaccessible areas under the house or up in the attic, away from the ability for the naked eye to see. There might be faulty wiring or termite damage or a cracked heat exchanger in the furnace. There might be some health and safety problems. You might have radon, a high level of radon in the basement, and you need to install a radon mitigation. Otherwise, there's a potential for cancer or some other things. And so it's not until an inspection happens that things under the surface are brought to light. And Paul says that there needs to be an examination of the people that are put forward to serve God as deacons or ministry servants. And when they are subjected to that scrutiny, it needs to be true that nothing blatant comes to the surface, so that all the cracks and crevices and all of the miscellaneous details of a person's life, they are able to withstand the scrutiny. Because I know full well as a human being, and perhaps you can attest to this as well, we are masters at concealing things sometimes. And it could be that there's a person that has a good exterior, but that is really sinning in an egregious way. And the testing should uncover that. You know, in Catholic churches, people that want to serve as deacons have to go through a 5-year process. They have to take courses. They have to write papers. I know this because my father-in-law is a deacon in the Catholic Church. And some people started off, and not everyone made it through. The ones that made it through, they interrogated the wives. Do you support this ministry? It might make sense also to ask the children of the potential candidate. I'm not saying that this needs to be something that is a 5-year process, but the Bible attests that there needs to be some scrutiny. Just because a person comes and has a desire, which is a good thing, does not mean that they should serve in this way. They should if after examination they pass the test with flying colors. Then Paul says they can commence their service. There are two other qualifications that parallel those of bishops. In verse 12. Verse 12 says this: a deacon must be faithful to his wife and must manage his children and his household well. If you want to get to know a person, you ask the people who live with them. If you want to know about me, ask April. She'll tell you some crazy things about me. But I hope that what she would say is that he's a person of integrity. He cares about our daughter. He cares about this family. I hope that's what she would say. Yes, he can be annoying sometimes. Yes, his sound effects are a little cuckoo. But he's a man that's striving to serve God. I hope that's what she would say. I know that that's what Jean would say about Troy. I know it's what Peggy would say about Ken. But what about you? What would the people that know you best say about you? Would they say, yes, he's fit to be a deacon? Would he say, yes, she's fit to serve God in this way? Or would they say, no, there's some stuff in the life, in the cracks that not everyone in the church can see, but that I see that I'm a little bit concerned about, if I was quite frankly honest with you about it. And so Paul says that the deacon must be a person who leads and manages his family well, and he must be faithful to his wife. If a person is not faithful to his wife, as I mentioned last week, then it's likely that that person won't be faithful to the church as well. And it's the case that children are reflections of their parents, and so this might be a reason why he says the deacon must manage his family well. If you've got a person that is set forward as a candidate and you look at the children and the children are wild and crazy and egregiously disobedient, I'm not talking about some minor faults, but they don't listen to anything, then it could be the case that that's an indication that such a person would not be a good individual to serve in this role. And so those are the qualifications of male deacons. And now I'd like to talk about verse 11. Verse 8 says, in the same way, deacons. And then verse 11 says, in the same way, the women, I'm reading from the NIV, the women are to be worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything. A deacon must be faithful to his wife and must manage his children and household well. Now, the question that I raised earlier, and this is an important question, is who does verse 11 refer to? So what I have on the side here are some supporting reasons for each of the different options in English translations. You'll notice that the NIV, RSV, NRSV has women. I think they do that to leave it ambiguous. Notice that the word for women in verse 11 and the word for wife is the same in Greek. It's translated differently, two different ways. The NIV, in that first example, seems to want to preserve some ambiguity. They might say, well, it could be wives of deacons, or it could be women in this office. And rather than make a case for it, they leave it deliberately ambiguous. That's my thinking there, is that there's a case that can be made for wives or women deacons. And so to preserve that ambiguity, let's just leave it as women in general. The second translation is wives. English Standard Version, King James, New King James, New American Standard Bible. Why would these versions translate verse 11 as wives? Well, you look at verse 12, right? Verse 12 has wife, and I think in the context, verse 12, that's the only thing it could be. You're talking about a man that manages his children and is faithful to his, well, you could say woman, but logically it makes sense that that would be his wife. Therefore, since it's certain that in verse 12, it's wife, the same word in verse 11 should be wife as well. You can see that. Two words in the same context should mean the same thing. There's the logic there. So it's referring to the wives of deacons. These are qualifications of the wives of deacons. The Revised English Bible takes another approach, and it says that this is an office of female deacons. This is women in this office. Now, why do they say that? Well, you notice when we talked about bishops last week, were there anything about their wives there? No, there wasn't. It just said that the bishop is to be faithful to his wife. There are no qualifications for how the wife of a bishop should be. Why would Paul not put how a bishop's wife should be and yet put information about how a deacon's wife should be? It makes sense that surely the overseer's wife should have some qualifications too, and not just the wife of a deacon. And so you can see the different rationales for translating this in a different way, and you can see the importance of it. Because if it is true that there was an order of female deacons, then it should make all the difference to the women in this church. If there were officially recognized women that served as deacons, I think personally, I think that verse 11 is a reference to women deacons in the church for biblical, secular, and historical reasons. I'll tell you why. It makes sense to me. Verse 11 falls right after Paul is talking about deacons. Now, in Greek at this time, there was no female word for deacon. So if you wanted to refer to a deacon, you would put a feminine article before the masculine form of deacon. And so Phoebe in Romans 16 is called a female deacon. The masculine form is used with the feminine article. And it may be that because there is not a word for a female deacon, besides doing it in that way, that Paul just assumes that it will carry over into verse 11. As he talks about men deacons, then the women deacons are discussed in verse 11. So here's why I believe that verse 11 should be taken as a reference to female deacons. In Romans chapter 16, verse 1, Paul mentions our sister Phoebe. The NIV translates a deacon of the church in Cenchreae. Now, some people will say that, well, it could be that Phoebe is serving in a non-technical sense. You remember I said the apostles are called servants, Timothy is called a servant. And so rather than calling Phoebe a deacon, she should just be just a regular servant. But oftentimes in Scripture, when deacons are mentioned in the context of a church, it means that they have an official role. So in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1, Paul writes to the church of Philippi with its bishops and deacons. And so some people will rationalize that because in Romans 16, there's a specific church that Phoebe is serving, it means she's serving in an official way. And I believe that that's pretty, I believe that that's pretty plausible. So there seems to be some biblical evidence for female deacons. Our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church in Synchrae. There's also secular evidence early. Non-Christian writing in the early second century, written by Pliny, who is the governor writing to the Emperor Trajan about 111, 112 AD. He's sent to investigate the province of Bithynia for disturbances and whatnot that Christians are causing. And he's trying to find out about the Christian faith. And so he takes these two female slaves, arrests them, and tortures them. And this is what he says. It was all the more necessary to extract the truth by torture from two slave women, whom the Christians call ministri in Latin, which is the Latin form of the Greek phrase for deacon. And so even secular testimony seems to indicate that there were early on females that served in the capacity in an officially recognized way in the early church. Now, that's not enough. There's also historical evidence. Most of the early interpreters of the Bible, the church fathers from the 2nd to the 4th centuries, Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Theodoret, John Chrysostom, Theodore of Mopsuestia, with few exceptions, most of them interpret 1 Timothy and Romans 16 as referring to an order of female deacons. If that's not enough, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, female deacons are explicitly mentioned in 3rd and 4th century texts. And so either that means that they weren't present in Scripture and that they eventually arose, or that they were and they continued. Now, I find this evidence convincing, and this is why I believe that chapter 3, verse 11 of 1 Timothy is a reference to a female order of deacons. And so you may be wondering, if there were female deacons that were officially recognized in the church, what did they do? Here's what they did. First off, there's evidence that they were ordained. I've taken a section from a prayer, probably going back to the 4th century, about the ordination of a female to the diaconate. And this is what it says. It invokes God to fill her with the grace of the diaconate, just as you gave the grace of your diaconate to Phoebe. So Phoebe is seen as the prototype of the female deacon, just like Stephen was for men who were ordained. Fill him with the grace just like you filled Stephen for the men. For the women, fill her with the grace just as you gave the grace of your diaconate to Phoebe, whom you called to this work of ministry. And so as a woman would come up and hands were laid on her, this prayer was said, at least going back to the 4th century. And so what were some of the duties of these female deacons? They were leaders of the female segment of the congregation. And so when baptisms were undertaken, the women deacons would not perform the baptisms, but they would assist at them. Why? Because baptisms at that time were primarily for adult candidates, and they were often done in the nude. And so to preserve modesty, when there was an anointing with oil, the women would do that. The female deacons would assist with that. They arranged places for women in church buildings. Shirley Serka brought up a few weeks ago that it was the case at certain times when church buildings became prominent that men and women often worshiped in different areas. And so the female deacons would arrange the places. They would welcome females. They would conduct interviews between the overseer. If the overseer had to talk to a woman, the female deacon would be there to preserve modesty and propriety. They had other roles. They catechized, which means that they taught. They would often be spiritual mothers for women in the congregation. So you get someone that wants to be a Christian, a female, a young female that wants to be up. Well, a female deacon would come and instruct her in the faith. And then after that person was baptized, the female deacon would help her grow in the faith. So to the point where the female deacon was understood to be a spiritual mother, specifically of the women in the church. They would visit. They would carry the Lord's Supper sometimes. They would perform social work and visit, especially among women in the congregation. There were certain limitations. They did not teach in church or administer baptism. They did not serve in the worship assembly in the same manner as male deacons. And so you see that even after a period of time, the church continued to observe limitations for women in ministries, but to also affirm this specific leadership role of ministering to women. And I think all of that's important. And so let's talk about the qualifications for women in verse 11. Chapter 3, verse 11. In the same way, the women are to be worthy of respect. Now, you'll notice that that's the same phrase that is used for men. It's the same phrase that is used for a bishop in terms of how he rules his family. His family follows him. Why? Because he is a man that invokes or prompts respect. Here's a man that lives an honorable life. It's the same with a woman. As she is a model of Christ's service to the congregation, she needs to be, first of all, a woman that invokes respect, an honorable woman. She needs to be not a malicious talker. She needs to be temperate. She needs to be restrained. She needs to be trustworthy in everything. And it might help to see the qualifications for female deacons, what I believe to be female deacons, in the context of the letter of 1 and 2 Timothy as a whole. There were women of different ages, chapter 5 and verse 2. Some of the widows were very needy and left all alone. And they had to rely on God for daily needs. I can envision a female deacon modeling what it means as you're going through difficult moments in your life. Here's what it means to rely on God for your daily needs. There were other widows who were self-indulgent and lived for pleasure. I could see a female deacon modeling what it is to live a well-regulated life, not to be given to much wine, not to take food in excess, to love her husband, to instill godly values in her children. There were younger women in 1 Timothy 5:13 that would go about from house to house, gossiping and being busybodies. I can envision a female deacon saying, this is how you use your mouth in a way that shows forth and sets forth integrity. 2 Timothy 3:6, some women are swayed by the error of false teachers. I can see these female teachers battling that, holding on to the deep truths of the faith and saying, no, you don't buy into that false stuff. I will help you to hold on to the true faith. And so one of the things that this text may call for is for seeds to be planted, for there to be consideration of people that are serving in a recognized capacity, both men and women, with overlapping roles, with some distinctions, observing the biblical limitations. Such a person should be able to withstand scrutiny, pass the test with flaming colors, and then that person should be officially recognized as a person that can serve. Verse 13 talks about the results of serving well. Verse 13. Those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. Now, this could be a reference to just the male deacons, or it could be a reference, if I'm right, that both men and female deacons are in view in this text. It could be a reference to both of them. If you have served well, you gain an excellent standing. If this is taken as something that happens in the present tense, it would mean that the lifestyle, the exemplary lifestyle, of a deacon that serves well gains a good standing in the community. They have a good reputation. They're known for being faithful. They're known for living in moderation. They're known for having a deep knowledge of the truths of the faith. And that gives them important standing in the community where they're recognized, as well as great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. Now, it could be that this is a reference to after deacons have died, if they have continued to the end and they've served well, then people may look at serving and say, oh, it's just a serving role, but God exalts it. And when the deacon, when the man or the female deacon stands before God and can testify by their life that they have faithfully served well, then God at the judgment will exalt them. There's a special reward for deacons and for elders who serve well. And perhaps this is what this text means. You've served well your entire life. This is what you should strive for. And when you stand before God, although the world may look down on people that serve, God exalts them to the highest place. And they have great confidence before the judgment seat of Christ. I think it has implications for the present. It also has implications for the future. And so what would this text call us to do? I think it would call us to evaluate our own lives and do a self-diagnostic. Men and women in this text are called to be people of integrity. They do the right thing no matter who's watching. And so it might be worth asking, what would people say about you in your life? What would your computer say about you? What would your phone say about the amount of time spent? What would the TV say about what you watch? What would the people that know you best say about you? Would your children say that you're a woman of integrity, a man of integrity? Would they say something else? What would your spouse say about you? What would your close friends say about you, about me? If your body could talk, what would it say about how you intake food and drink? Would it say that you partake of food in a healthy way? Or would it say that you partake to excess? Would it say that you drink wine in moderation? Or would it say that you drink to excess? What about any dating relationships or other relationships? What would that person say about you? There's also an inspection. If our life was scrutinized so that everything hidden became known, what would come to light? And perhaps this morning, there's a secret sin that is coming to light that needs to be dealt with. And maybe that needs confession and repentance. There is forgiveness for those who confess. And lastly, it's a call for service. Whether it's in an official way as a recognized role as a man or a female deacon, or an unofficial role, someone that is ready to serve, it might be worth thinking about what your spiritual gifts are and how you're using it to serve the church. 100% of Christians have spiritual gifts, and 100% of Christians should use those gifts to serve. Whether it's in an official way or an unofficial way, whether there's a title given associated with the role or whether it's not. Maybe it's just, I want to take care of the kids today. Maybe it's, I just want to teach this class today. Maybe it's, I want to get involved with the caring ministry. I don't have to have the word deacon by the title, but I can still serve because I have a gift to do this. And so there's a call for all of us to get involved, to serve as a response to Jesus' ministry of service. He served to the point where he laid down his life. And out of gratitude to that, we willingly serve him and exercise the use of the gifts that he's given. And so I asked the elders, both Troy and Ken, about some specific areas that people can get plugged in. If you have one of the directories, I think there may still be some outside. If you turn to the end of it, there's a list of the different ministries. The groundskeeping, the caregiving ministry, color more, worry less. There's a long list of ministries. Many of them could use help. Here are some specific areas that Troy and Ken mentioned. There's an area that we'd like people to get involved, community outreach and service projects. Troy writes that it would probably take a couple of people who have a good vision of how to reach out to the community and find opportunities to serve. If you are a visionary, if you are a dreamer, and you have a heart for this community, we need a couple of people to step in and take on that role. You don't have to be an official deacon to do that, just a gifted person. We need someone who has the gift of encouragement. Troy writes, he's not sure what this should be called, but a person or a couple of people that can help identify gifts of members and new people and help them connect with the ministry. Troy writes that I think getting people involved quickly will help them feel more connected with the church family. And being plugged in will help them have a sense of belonging and make them want to stay. Here are a couple of ministries that have potential gaps that the elders think are critical for the church family. And my opportunity, I want to take the opportunity to thank both Ben and Kevin for their service. It's often the case, I don't fully understand all that goes into computers, but on Wednesday night, Kevin is often juggling between different microphones, switching between PowerPoints and songs, reading comments about like, oh, I can't hear, and fixing that. It takes a lot of work. And Kevin did not ask me to say that, but I think he would appreciate if someone that has some technology skills that can share some of the burden of that. Again, he didn't ask me to say that. I just think that it's something that we could use some additional help with. Technology. The caring ministry. If there are people that really want to write letters and send cards to people that have not been here in a while or that are hurting or ill and they want to check in and make sure that everything is okay. If we have people that get sick and are hurt or that have a surgery, this is an area where people can serve. If God has given you a heart for this ministry, then there's room to get plugged in. Missions is a big gap. Troy writes, I have always had a heart for missions, and I think it is important for congregations to try and help good mission work when possible. If you're a person that is committed to evangelizing in the community, or you'd like to see that happen, or you'd like to oversee this ministry and help us be a church that is evangelistic, then this would be a call for service. There's a facility maintenance and upkeep with the grounds outside, cutting grass, snow removal, raking leaves, and things of that sort. The children's ministry, often it's the case that the same three or four people take the children, and that's an important ministry. If we had gifted individuals or people that love children that would like to invest in the future of this church, then that would be an opportunity. There are others. That's not an exhausted list. But there's a call from this text to serve. And I hope that all of us are left considering with how we can use our gifts to do just that, whether it's an official way as a recognized deacon or whether it's an unofficial capacity where we are exercising our gifts to serve God. If you'd like to start serving, if you'd like to become a part of this church, then may it be today that you make that response and prayerfully consider how we can assist you in doing so while we stand and sing the song that's been prepared for us.